A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this prompt, and it's one of those questions that makes you realize how strange our own normal is. We walk around in climate-controlled bubbles, spending billions of dollars to not smell like biological organisms, and we think this is baseline human existence. For 99% of history, nobody took a daily hot shower. Nobody used aerosol antiperspirant. So what did clean even mean when you hauled your water from a well and your cleaning products came from a tree in Somalia? That's the core of what we're digging into. The scented oils of the ancient world, the public bath as infrastructure, and when the private shower actually became a thing regular people could expect.
It's genuinely weirder than most people realize. The private daily shower is not some ancient human right. It's a post-World War II phenomenon for the average person. We're talking about a 70-year-old norm that we've elevated to moral necessity. If you skip a shower, you feel like you failed at being civilized. That's an incredibly recent invention.
The Great Deodorization. That's what we should call this shift. The move from managing smell to preventing it entirely. Ancient people weren't just walking around reeking and shrugging. They had systems. They were just completely different systems, built around different materials, different infrastructure, different assumptions about what a body is supposed to do.
That's the three pillars we should walk through. 1. The scented oil strategy of the ancient world, which was much more sophisticated than just slapping on perfume. 2. The public bath as civic infrastructure, especially in Rome, where bathing was a utility, not a luxury. And 3. The plumbing revolution that eventually put a private shower in every home, which required an almost absurd amount of technological and social change to pull off.
The history of hygiene is basically a history of class. Who could afford to not smell like a human? Who had access to water, to fuel for heating it, to the oils and tools that made cleaning work? And what did everybody else do?
I want to be careful here, because it's easy to look back and think of ancient people as dirty or primitive. That's not what this is about. They had different constraints and different solutions. Some of those solutions were remarkably clever. The Roman strigil, for example, a curved metal blade you scraped across your skin to remove oil and sweat and dirt, no soap involved. And it worked.
Like a windshield squeegee for the human body.
It's not a failure of imagination, it's a different chemical approach. We dissolve dirt and oil with soap and rinse it away. They bound dirt and oil to a carrier oil and scrape the whole mixture off. Both methods remove the gunk. They just took different paths.
Let's start with the scented oil thing, because this is what the prompt is really curious about. Were ancient people just covering up their stink with frankincense and myrrh?
The short answer is no, but the long answer is much more interesting. Scented oils in the ancient world were a functional technology, not just a cosmetic cover-up. Heavy resinous oils, frankincense, myrrh, labdanum, have very low volatility. They don't evaporate quickly. That means they sit on the skin for hours. And crucially, they act as fixatives. They physically bind to and encapsulate volatile fatty acids, which are the actual source of body odor. Those short-chain fatty acids are what bacteria produce when they break down sweat, and they're highly volatile. They leap off your skin and into the air. A heavy oil traps them.
It's not masking. It's more like...
You're creating a barrier that slows down the release of those odor compounds. Modern perfumery still uses this exact principle. Ingredients like ambroxan, iso-E super, certain musk compounds, they're fixatives. They don't smell strong themselves, but they hold more volatile scent molecules in place. The ancient world figured out the same trick using tree resins.
Which, by the way, were astronomically expensive. Frankincense came from what's now Somalia and southern Arabia, traded up through the Red Sea and overland to the Mediterranean. Myrrh came from similar regions. These weren't local herbs you could gather from the hillside.
Pliny the Elder complained about this constantly. He wrote that Rome was spending 100 million sesterces every year on perfumes from Arabia. Depending on how you calculate purchasing power, that's somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 to $100 million annually. On scented oils and incense. And Pliny was furious. He saw it as decadence, as money flowing out of the empire to pay for luxury nonsense.
100 million sesterces of what was essentially the ancient equivalent of the Axe body spray aisle, except it actually worked and cost more than most people made in a year.
That's the sweat gap right there. If you were wealthy, you had access to these imported oils. You'd apply them after bathing, or even as part of the bathing process itself. If you were poor, an urban laborer, a slave, a rural farmer, you weren't buying frankincense oil from Somalia. You were using water when you could get it, maybe a pumice stone to scrub off dead skin, and if you had access to a public bath, estridgel, and some basic olive oil. Olive oil was the cheap, accessible alternative. It worked as a cleaning agent, but it didn't have the fixative properties or the scent profile of the expensive resins.
The ancient world smelled like a class hierarchy. The rich smelled of frankincense and myrrh, literally the gifts of kings. The poor smelled of olive oil and whatever their labor produced.
Probably of smoke, in many cases. Most people cooked and heated with wood or charcoal. Smoke permeates everything. Clothing, hair, skin. It's its own kind of scent mask, though not a pleasant one. The point is, the scented oil strategy was real and effective, but it was also a marker of status. This wasn't a universal solution. It was a luxury product being used as a hygiene technology.
Which brings us to the Roman baths, because that was the thing that actually democratized cleanliness, at least somewhat. The baths were infrastructure. They were public utilities. And they were massive.
The baths of Caracalla are the poster child here. Completed around 216 AD, they could hold 1,600 bathers at once. 1,600 people, simultaneously, in a complex that included hot baths, warm baths, cold baths, exercise yards, libraries, gardens, shops. The main building was over 700 feet long. The hypocaust system, the underfloor heating, burned more than 10 tons of wood every single day to keep the floors and walls warm and to heat the water.
10 tons of wood a day. That's a small forest every week, just to keep one bath complex running.
Rome had hundreds of baths. Not all at the Caracalla scale, but the fuel consumption was enormous. The wood had to be brought in from increasingly distant forests. Aqueducts bringing in millions of gallons of water, furnaces burning constantly, teams of workers maintaining the whole system.
Entry cost a quadrans, a tiny bronze coin, basically pocket change. Most free citizens could afford it. That's what makes it so interesting. This massive, resource-intensive infrastructure was accessible to nearly everyone.
Nearly everyone, with a caveat. Free citizens, yes. Slaves, probably not, though some may have attended as attendants to their owners. Women had separate hours or separate facilities in many cases. And the quadrants got you in the door, but if you wanted oil for your estridgel, or a towel, or a snack from a vendor, that cost extra. So there were still gradations of experience. But the baseline access was remarkably broad.
The bath wasn't just about getting clean. It was a social institution. You went there to do business, to politic, to gossip, to exercise, to read, to just be around other people. It was the Roman equivalent of the coffee shop, the gym, the spa, and the town square all rolled into one.
The bathing routine itself is worth describing, because it's so different from our quick shower and out mentality. You'd arrive, change in the apodyterium, then move through a sequence of rooms. You'd start in the tepidarium, the warm room, to acclimate, then the caldarium, the hot room, where you'd sweat profusely, then you'd apply oil to your skin, often olive oil, sometimes scented if you were wealthy, and use your estridgel to scrape off the oil along with the sweat and accumulated grime. Then you might move to the frigidarium, the cold plunge pool, to close your pores and invigorate yourself. The whole process could take hours.
The estridgel is the part that blows my mind. It's a curved metal blade, bronze or iron, and you scrape yourself with it. No rinse and repeat. You oil up, you scrape down, and that's the cleaning mechanism. It's so alien to our water and lather intuition.
Think about what soap requires. You need fat and an alkali. Wood ash, traditionally, and you need to combine them through a chemical process to produce a salt of a fatty acid. That technology existed in the ancient world. The Babylonians were making soap-like substances around 2800 BC, but the Romans didn't adopt soap for bathing. They knew about it. The Gauls and Germans used soap, and Roman writers mentioned it. But in Roman culture, the oil and strigil method was the standard. Soap was a barbarian thing, associated with hair care and laundry more than with body cleaning.
The Romans looked at soap and said, "No thanks, we'll stick with our curved metal body squeegee."
Honestly, it worked. The combination of heat, oil, and mechanical scraping removes dirt, dead skin, and sweat effectively. It's different from our method, but it's not worse. And it doesn't require the massive water infrastructure that a shower does. The water in a Roman bath was for soaking and rinsing, not for the primary cleaning action.
The Roman bath was a public utility that solved the sanitation problem, provided a social hub, and was accessible to most of the population. And then it all collapsed.
The fall of the Roman baths in Western Europe is one of those historical transitions that doesn't get enough attention. As the empire fragmented, the aqueducts fell into disrepair, the hypocaust furnaces went cold, and the institutional knowledge to maintain these massive systems faded. But it wasn't just technical decay. The early Christian church had serious objections to public bathing. The baths were associated with pagan culture, with nudity, with the kind of mixed-gender socializing that church authorities saw as immoral. Bathing became suspect. Cleanliness wasn't next to godliness yet. That idea comes much later.
You've got physical infrastructure crumbling and a cultural shift that says bathing is maybe a little sinful. Perfect storm for 1,000 years of being really, really smelly.
The Middle Ages get a bad rap for hygiene, and it's not entirely fair. People did wash. They used basins and cloths. They visited bathhouses where they existed. But the scale and sophistication of Roman bathing was gone. By the medieval period, you see occasional bathhouses in cities, but they're often associated with, let's say, extracurricular activities. They became known as places where you might find more than a hot soak. That reputation further discouraged the church and civic authorities from supporting them.
The sauna is Weißer Denn Pipeline. Some things never change.
Then you have the Black Death in the 14th century, which killed off a lot of the remaining public bathing culture. People became afraid that bathing opened the pores and let disease in. That's actually a medical theory of the time, that water, especially hot water, weakened the body's defenses by opening it up to miasmas, bad airs. So for several centuries, the medical establishment actively discouraged bathing. This is where you get the image of the filthy medieval European. It's not entirely a myth, though it varied enormously by region and class.
How do we climb out of that? How do we get from bathing will kill you to you must shower daily or you're a failure?
The return of public bathing in the 19th century is the bridge. And it wasn't driven by luxury or social life. It was driven by cholera. The Industrial Revolution packed people into cities with no sanitation infrastructure. Working class housing had no running water, no drainage, no bathing facilities. Human waste accumulated in cesspits and gutters. The Thames in London was an open sewer, and cholera swept through these populations repeatedly.
The Great Stink of 1858. The Thames got so foul that Parliament had to hang lime-soaked curtains over the windows, and they seriously considered relocating the government.
Edwin Chadwick's 1842 report on the sanitary condition of the laboring population of Great Britain is one of those documents that changed everything. He documented, in meticulous detail, that most working-class families had no access to a private bath, no dedicated washroom, often no reliable access to clean water at all. The report helped drive the Public Health Act of 1848 and a wave of public bathhouse construction across British industrial cities. Liverpool, London, Manchester. They built public baths and washhouses where working people could bathe and do laundry for a small fee. These weren't social hubs like the Roman baths, they were public health mandates. Get in, get clean, get out.
Function over form. The brutalist architecture of hygiene.
They were hugely popular. Millions of visits per year in some cities. They demonstrated that if you provide the infrastructure, people will use it. But they also demonstrated how far we were from the private bathroom. Even with these facilities, the average person was bathing maybe once a week. The daily bath or shower was still a fantasy for most of the population.
When does the private shower actually become a thing? Because the prompt asks specifically, when did it become realistic to expect a daily shower in your own home?
The private shower has a surprisingly long technical history, but a very short practical one. The first mechanical shower was patented in 1767 by William Feedham. It was a hand pump device that recirculated the same water over and over. Not exactly hygienic. The English Regency shower, developed in the early 1800s, used a hand pump to force water up from a basin through a tank and out a shower head. It was cold water, required significant physical effort to operate, and was basically a rich person's novelty.
You're standing there pumping a handle to get a trickle of cold water on your head, and this is the cutting edge.
The Mott's patent shower bath of 1826 shows what the market looked like. It was essentially a large metal basin you stood in, with a tank above you that you filled by hand. You pulled a chain to release the water. It was cold, it was awkward, and the pipes were often made of lead, the same material we now know causes neurological damage. So you're showering in water that's been sitting in lead pipes, actively poisoning you. And this was a luxury item.
The lead poisoning shower. Build me a product nobody notices is slowly destroying them.
The real turning point requires a convergence of technologies that didn't come together until the early 20th century. You need municipal water treatment. Chlorination doesn't become widespread until the 1910s and 1920s. You need cheap, non-toxic piping. Copper becomes standard in the 1920s and 1930s, replacing lead. You need reliable water heating. Gas water heaters become affordable in the 1920s. And you need the bathroom as a dedicated room in the house, which requires suburban housing stock with indoor plumbing.
All of these things have to converge. Water treatment, safe pipes, water heaters, and houses built with bathrooms. That's a lot of infrastructure that has to exist before you can even think about a daily shower.
The numbers bear this out. The Bureau of Labor Statistics did a study in 1929 called the Standard of Living Study. They found that only 50% of American homes had a bathtub or shower. The other half used a wash tub in the kitchen. You'd heat water on the stove, pour it into the tub, and take a sponge bath. That was the norm for half the country. And this is 1929, the Roaring Twenties, the height of pre-Depression prosperity. If half of American homes didn't have a bathtub in 1929, you can imagine what the numbers looked like earlier and elsewhere.
The daily shower isn't a thing for most people until when?
Post-World War II. The 1950s is when it really becomes normalized in the United States. The GI Bill fuels a suburban housing boom, and those houses are built with bathrooms as standard. Municipal water systems expand. Electric and gas water heaters become cheap and reliable. And simultaneously, you have the rise of modern marketing. Soap companies, deodorant companies, shampoo companies, all pushing the message that you need to use their products every single day. The daily shower isn't just infrastructure, it's a cultural creation driven by advertising.
This is where deodorant enters the story, because the daily shower alone doesn't make you odorless for 24 hours. You need the chemical intervention too.
The deodorant timeline is fascinating. The first commercial deodorant was Mum, introduced in 1888. It was a cream, a zinc-based paste you applied with your fingers. It killed odor-causing bacteria. But it was messy, inconvenient, and not something most people use daily. Deodorant was a niche product for decades.
The glockenspiel of corporate approachability.
The real game changer was Stepette, launched in 1947. It was the first aerosol antiperspirant. It came in a spray bottle, it was easy to apply, and it didn't just mask odor, it actively prevented sweating. The active ingredient was aluminum chloride, which temporarily plugs sweat ducts. This was a fundamental shift. Before Stepette, the idea was to wash off smell or cover it up. After Stepette, the idea was to prevent sweat from happening at all.
Stepette was originally marketed as a deodorant for the underarm area of women's dresses. It wasn't even a body product. It was a garment protection product. Keep your dress fresh, not your body.
Which tells you everything about who the target market was and what the framing was. This was about preserving expensive clothing, not about personal hygiene per se. But the framing shifted quickly. Within a decade, antiperspirant was being marketed as a daily necessity for everyone, and the social norm of odorlessness was being cemented.
Let me piece this together. The daily shower becomes physically possible for most Americans in the 1950s. The aerosol antiperspirant arrives in 1947 and becomes mainstream in the 1950s. By 1960, we've got the full modern hygiene stack. Daily hot shower, antiperspirant, shampoo, the works. And within a generation, this goes from luxury to moral requirement.
That's the thing that I think is worth sitting with. we've taken a set of technologies that required massive infrastructure investment. Water treatment plants, miles of copper piping, gas lines or electrical grids for water heating, chemical manufacturing for deodorants, and we've normalized the output so completely that if someone doesn't shower for a day, we treat it as a social failure. We've moralized infrastructure.
The history of hygiene is a history of energy and water infrastructure. Your daily shower consumes roughly 20 gallons of heated water. Heating that water requires energy. Treating that water before and after requires energy and chemical inputs. Every shower is a little monument to fossil fuels and municipal engineering. And we've convinced ourselves this is the natural state of the human body.
The scented oil strategy, which we dismissed as primitive for decades, was actually a much lower resource approach. It didn't require plumbing, it didn't require water treatment, it didn't require a constant supply of heated water. It used materials that were expensive in their time, yes, but the resource footprint per cleaning event was tiny compared to a modern shower.
Which brings up an uncomfortable question. If energy costs keep rising and water becomes scarcer, and we're already seeing serious drought conditions in lots of places, does the daily shower become a luxury again? Are we heading back toward a world where scented oils and strategic spot cleaning make more sense than standing under hot running water for 10 minutes every morning?
There's already a movement in this direction in some circles. The no-poo hair care movement, people who've stopped using shampoo and use water, only washing or alternative methods. The rise of skin fasting, where people reduce or eliminate skincare products. The growing market for natural deodorants that don't block sweat but use antibacterial ingredients and scent management. These are all, in a way, rediscovering pre-modern approaches through a modern lens.
The public bath is making a comeback, too, though in a very different form. The Korean spa, the Russian banya, the Scandinavian sauna culture. These are social bathing experiences gaining popularity in the West. They're not replacing the private shower, but they're supplementing it with something we lost when the Roman baths closed. The social experience of being around other bodies, of bathing as a community activity rather than a private ritual.
What did we lose when we moved from public baths to private showers? Social cohesion, for one. The Roman bath was a place where people of different classes and backgrounds mixed, not entirely equally, but more than anywhere else in Roman society. It was a shared experience of the body. Everyone has to clean themselves. The bath made that commonality visible. The private shower makes it invisible. You're alone with your hygiene, alone with your body, alone with your judgment of whether you're clean enough.
There's something almost monastic about the modern bathroom. It's a cell for solitary purification. You go in dirty. You emerge clean. No one witnesses the transformation. It's the opposite of the Roman bath, where the whole process was public and social.
The scented oil strategy is interesting on this front too, because it's inherently a more social approach to smell. If you're wearing a heavy, complex scent, frankincense, myrrh, a blend of oils, that's a public statement. It announces your presence. It's part of how you move through social space. Modern deodorization is the opposite. The goal is to smell like nothing, to be scent invisible. It's the hygiene equivalent of beige wallpaper.
The unscented human is the lo-fi girl of the 21st century, present but deliberately not making an impression.
We've pathologized the alternative. If someone smells strongly, even if something pleasant, like a natural musk or a scented oil, we code it as unprofessional, as intrusive, as a failure of self-management. We've created a norm where the only acceptable scent is no scent, or a scent so subtle and standardized that it reads as clean rather than perfumed. That's a very strange place to land, historically speaking.
Where does the Roman bath sit on the luxury versus necessity question? Because the prompt asks about this directly. Was it a luxury experience, or was it driven by the lack of home sanitation?
It's both, and that's what makes it such an interesting institution. The lack of home plumbing absolutely drove the demand. Most Romans lived in insulae, apartment buildings, often 6 or 7 stories tall, with no running water above the ground floor. If you wanted to bathe, you either used a basin in your apartment, hauling water up multiple flights of stairs, or you went to the baths. The baths were the practical solution to a city where private bathing was physically impossible for most residents.
It's infrastructure solving a collective action problem. You can't put a bathtub in a 6-floor walk-up with no plumbing, so you build a public facility that handles 1,600 people at once.
It was also a luxury experience, even at the low entry price. The baths were beautiful. Marble floors, mosaic walls, soaring vaulted ceilings, gardens, libraries, art. The baths of Caracalla had sculptures that are now in museums. The experience of being there was designed to be pleasurable, not merely functional. The Romans understood that if you wanted people to use a public facility, you had to make it attractive. It's the opposite of the brutalist public bath of the 19th century, which was designed to be purely functional and a little bit punitive.
The Roman bath was the Apple Store of ancient hygiene. Beautiful, accessible, makes you want to be there. The Victorian public bath was the DMV.
If you couldn't afford even the quadrant's entry fee, if you were a slave or desperately poor or living in a rural area far from any bath complex, then you made do. Water from a well or a stream, a rag in a basin, maybe some cheap oil if you could get it, a pumice stone to scrub. And yes, if you could scrape together enough for some scented oil, you might use it to manage odor, because the alternative was simply smelling like whatever your body and your labor produced.
The sweat gap again. The wealthy have frankincense and the baths. The poor have a cold basin and whatever they can find.
This pattern persists through history. The 1842 Chadwick Report, the working class in industrial Britain had essentially the same options as the Roman poor. A basin, a cloth, cold water, and a weekly trip to a public bath if one existed nearby. The spit bath, that's actually what it was called, using a damp cloth to wash the essential areas, was the standard hygiene practice for most of the population well into the 20th century.
There's a term that really sells the glamour of pre-modern hygiene.
The full-body immersion bath was a weekly event at most for ordinary people, and often less frequent than that. You heated water on the stove, which took time and fuel, filled a tub in the kitchen, and the whole family used the same water, one after another. The phrase, "don't throw the baby out with the bathwater," comes from this practice. By the time the baby got bathed, the water was so murky you might not see the child in there. That's not a joke. That's the actual origin.
We're only two or three generations removed from this. Our grandparents or great-grandparents bathed this way.
The normalization of the daily private shower is so recent that there are people alive today who remember when it wasn't the norm. We've compressed millennia of hygiene evolution into a single lifetime, and we've completely naturalized the endpoint. We think this is how humans have always wanted to live. But for most of history, the idea of standing under hot running water every single day would have seemed like an insane extravagance.
Let me pull on one more thread before we move to wrapping up. The frankincense chemistry you mentioned. You said the resin has boswellic acids with anti-inflammatory properties. Was there a medicinal dimension to this, or was it purely about scent?
There was absolutely a medicinal dimension. Frankincense has been used in traditional medicine for thousands of years, in Ayurveda, in traditional Chinese medicine, in Middle Eastern practices. The boswellic acids do have genuine anti-inflammatory effects. They've been studied for arthritis, for inflammatory bowel disease, for asthma. So when someone in the ancient world applied frankincense oil to their skin, they might have been getting a dual benefit, odor management and actual therapeutic effects on skin inflammation or joint pain.
It's not just a deodorant. It's a deodorant that also treats your aches and pains. The ancient world's version of a product that does everything.
Myrrh has its own properties. Antimicrobial, astringent, used for wound healing and oral health. These weren't just pretty smells. They were functional materials that happened to smell good. The scent was part of the function, not separate from it. That's a very different relationship to fragrance than what we have now, where scent is purely aesthetic and often completely disconnected from any other function.
Modern deodorant has exactly one job, and it does it with aluminum compounds that we're still arguing about the safety of. The ancients had a multifunctional botanical approach that we're now rediscovering through the lens of natural products.
Which is its own kind of irony. The premium natural deodorant you buy at a health food store for $12, the one with essential oils and botanical extracts, is essentially a modern version of the ancient scented oil strategy. We've come full circle, except now it costs $12 and comes in biodegradable packaging. If I'm pulling all of this together, the answer to the prompt has a few layers. Yes, ancient people used scented oils, but it wasn't just covering up. It was a chemical strategy for binding odor compounds. The Roman bath was both a practical response to the lack of home plumbing and a luxury social institution, accessible to most free citizens at pocket change prices. The daily private shower is a post-1950 phenomenon for the average person, made possible by municipal water treatment, safe plumbing, affordable water heating, and suburban housing stock. Before that, the typical practice was a weekly basin bath, a trip to a public bathhouse if one existed, and for much of history, simply managing odor rather than eliminating it.
The through line in all of this is infrastructure. What kind of water systems do you have? What kind of energy do you have access to? What materials can you afford? Hygiene isn't a moral quality, it's a material condition. We've built a world where daily odorlessness is possible for billions of people, and we should appreciate how remarkable that is. But we should also recognize how fragile it is, and how recent.
The open question I keep coming back to is this. As water scarcity increases, as energy costs rise, as we confront the environmental cost of heating 20 gallons of water per person per day, does the daily shower become a luxury again? And if it does, what replaces it? Do we see a return to the scented oil strategy? A new generation of public bathhouses? Or something we haven't invented yet?
The sweaty human is not a bug. It's a feature. We've spent millennia trying to engineer our way out of being biological organisms, and we've succeeded to a degree that would astonish our ancestors. But maybe the next innovation isn't a better antiperspirant. Maybe it's a better acceptance of what bodies actually do.
That's a lovely place to land. We've been chasing odorlessness for a century, and we've achieved it. At enormous infrastructure cost, with products that we're still not entirely sure are safe, in a way that's isolated us from each other and from our own bodies. Maybe the future of hygiene looks less like a better shower and more like a better relationship with the fact that we're animals.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1500s, lava tubes in Papua New Guinea were observed to produce distinct acoustic resonances. Local oral traditions describe them as singing caves, because certain pitches would sustain for over 30 seconds, a property caused by the exceptionally smooth, glassy walls formed by fast-flowing basaltic lava.
Singing caves. Of course there are singing caves.
30 seconds of sustain. That's better reverb than most recording studios.
This has been my weird prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps. You can find show notes and more at My Weird Prompts. We'll be back soon with another one.
Until then, maybe skip a shower. It's historically authentic.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.